You may have got a, hopefully got an email from me this week explaining that we are in the process of hiring a new pastor. It's 5 weeks ago that we said goodbye to Brian, Brian Peterson, believe it or not. So we are in the process of hiring a new pastor. And in that email, you'd have probably seen that we were asking for your help in three ways. One is to get the word out about that. The role description's on the website. You can check that out. And some of you may be interested in the role. We'd love to hear from you if that's the case. But just help us get the word out. Secondly, obviously, the two pastors at the moment, that's myself and Ruth, are kind of managing three roles. So we're, you know, there's a fair bit of work to do. So we just ask everybody to be understanding, patient with us. Everything's in order. We've made adjustments accordingly, but obviously, you know, things are pretty busy at the moment. So just you know, manage our expectations and be patient. And then thirdly, you can help. So, you know, most of the work in our community happens through volunteers. So you, on that email, you've had a link to sign up for some really key needs that we have for volunteers. Things like our children's ministry, our farm, making coffee on Sundays, all that kind of thing. And so you can go back to that email, click on that link and sign up that way. Or we have a sign up table out in the commons area. So afterwards, just head out there and sign up with the old fashioned way with pen and paper. We'd really love to hear from you. And we, you know, as you can imagine, we really need everybody's help at the moment. I mean, we always do. It's not just during this season, but if you could sign up, that would be great. Okay, we're going to continue our series this morning called Exploring the Depths, Our Faith in Progress. And if you remember, we've been looking at some pretty, you know, challenging topics. I think we can put that list up here. We've got it here. These are the 4 weeks that we're spending looking at subjects like who is God? What is God like? What is God like? We did that over the first 2 weeks. Today, we're going to look at the issue of who is Jesus? And then next week, we'll look at what is faith? So these are big, challenging issues. I'm going to give my caveats again at the beginning here. I'm going to share my own perspective. It's very subjective, you know, inevitably. And none of us know the answers to these questions, right? I would say, and I don't think any human being ever has done down through the centuries. It's a mystery, and we're exploring this mystery. We're exploring the depths of this mystery because it's worth exploring. We want to search for meaning and understanding in as dynamic a way as we possibly can. Today, we're going to look at who is Jesus, and in some respects, that might be a bit easier. You know, we've been talking about who is God, what is God like. That's somewhat abstract, and we've been trying to kind of wrestle with these abstract issues and wrestle them to the ground. But at the same time, when we think about Jesus, okay, there's this person, Jesus, who existed in history. There's all sorts of questions about, yeah, but who was he? Who is he? Because the Christian tradition has had all kinds of claims about Jesus down through the centuries, like some of these, for instance. Like, this is not an exhaustive list, but these are some of the things that Christians down through the centuries have said about Jesus. First of all, there's Jesus of Nazareth, the historical figure. Okay, so someone who existed in history. We're just going to explore that a little bit this morning. There's, you know, Christians believe Jesus is the Messiah. That's a Hebrew term, you know, part of the Jewish tradition that a Messiah would come. And followers of Jesus believe Jesus is the Messiah. That's a label. That's an identity we give to Jesus when we answer this question: who is Jesus? We also talk about Son of God. He's referred to as the Son of God. Jesus referred to himself very often as the Son of Man. We're not going to touch so much on those today. Those two things. Not to say they're not important, but you know, they're somewhat ambiguous as well, because other people in the Bible are called Son of God. And also, if you think about it, we're called children of God, sons and daughters of God. So, you know, that's not necessarily exclusively a label for Jesus, but it's one that's used for Jesus. And we'll touch on that a little bit. Son of Man is a term Jesus, as I mentioned, used for himself. It's a strange term. It appears in other parts of the Bible too, referring to other people, particularly in the Hebrew scriptures, so in books like Ezekiel and Daniel, and then in the Christian scriptures right at the end in the book of Revelation. But Jesus sort of associated himself with this figure in kind of apocalyptic terms, and a lot of the apocalyptic literature in the Gospels which we'll look at this morning. We're not going to look at the apocalyptic elements, but they use this term Son of Man, or Jesus uses this term Son of Man. We're not really going to touch on that too much, but there, I'm just going through some of the labels, some of the identity labels we have for Jesus. Then we call Jesus Lord, right? And that's a divine term. So here we're getting into the divinity of Jesus. We're going to explore that a little bit this morning, sort of under the heading of, or the subject matter of, the cosmic Christ, or the universal Christ, or the Christ Logos, this pretty incredible, somewhat abstract, but incredibly significant identity that Christians give Jesus. We see there, you know, with the divinity part, we see this issue of Jesus as being a human and divine, this thing that Christians have believed down through the centuries. And we get that kind of those connotations there in the labels Son of God and Son of Man. We have this mixture of deity and humanity. And then we also refer to Jesus as Savior. And I'm going to not even touch that one this week. I'm going to punt it into next week, because we have so much to do today. We won't be out of here before 1 p.m. I'm absolutely convinced. No, I'll do my best. So these are some of the labels that we have for Jesus. So I think also, as we've been talking about, when we've been looking at who is God, what is God like, we all have these sort of notions, especially if we've grown up in church, I think especially, it's almost a hindrance. We have these notions of Jesus, just like we have notions of God. You know, we have these images of God in our mind that may or may not be accurate, may or may not be helpful. And likewise, we have these images of Jesus. And it's kind of, Jesus was a human being. There was somebody called Jesus of Nazareth, but it's really hard to imagine that, right? Here's some images that we've used, again, down through the centuries. So they're sort of iconic religious images. I'm pretty sure Jesus didn't look like that, though. Right, I don't think Jesus was walking around like this all the time with a book tucked under his arm. But they can be helpful, but they're not necessarily historically accurate. Then we have other images of Jesus, like this one, which is absolutely nowhere near accurate. That does not look like a Palestinian right there. That's more of a Swedish Jesus, I guess, with a heart. I don't know what's going on there. So we're trying to capture. This is a way to, and I'm not trying to mock any of these images, because I have equally bizarre images of Jesus in my own mind. I mean, when it comes to God, I'm still most of the time thinking Gandalf, right? And Gandalf the gray, not the white, not so much with the pointy hat, but I have these images, right, that are probably not very helpful at all. But there's an image of Jesus. We also then try and put Jesus, because that captures his divinity, perhaps in some way we're trying to, but then we kind of, no, Jesus is a human being. So we have images like this, which just, it's not working, is it? And I don't know what the cross is doing in the background there. It's like goalposts or something. I don't know what that is. Or an image like this, which is ironically what we teach our kids. That's mean Jesus, you know, holding the ball out of reach of the poor little children. Or we have images like this. There's the, what that I would call the good looking Jesus, you know, the very similar to Aragorn. Don't you think, if we look at the next slide, kind of Aragorn Jesus, right? Then in a more sinister way, because that's kind of funny, but we kind of project our own culture, our own identity, our own nationality even onto Jesus. We have the American Jesus, right? I mean, that's a very real issue, problematic issue. If we're going to go after an American Jesus, we're probably more likely to look at something like this, right? There's an American Jesus, another American Jesus, different kind of Jesus. There has been research done, though, and this isn't a build-up to a joke. There has been research done on the anthropological research, anatomical research on what might a first century Palestinian Jewish male in his 30s look like, and they've come up with images like this, right? So now I don't know whether that's realistic, but that's a very human figure, right? That's a very human figure there. That's probably not the image that most followers of Jesus carry around in their minds necessarily, but we capture something of the humanity of Jesus, I think, in a picture like that. And Jesus was a human being. There is a historical person called Jesus of Nazareth. Now, history is pretty scant in recounting about Jesus's life. If we look at some of the non-Christian sources for information about Jesus. We've got some sort of second century, sort of late first and early second century references to Jesus. So these are references well after Jesus. They're sort of retrospective, they're looking back. Pliny the Younger, you may have heard of Pliny the Younger. He was a governor of a town in present-day Turkey called Bithynia. Not to be confused, actually, look at the next slide. Not to be confused with the beer, Pliny the Younger. Has anybody ever drunk that? Anybody had that? Russian River Brewing. It regularly gets voted, or did, I'm out of touch these days, the best IPA in the world. Well, in America, but that's the, you know, it's like baseball. You have the World Series, and I guess you let one or two other people play in it. But anyway, but let's get back to our list. Pliny the Younger was a governor, and he wrote to the Emperor Trajan in the early second century to say, got a bit of a problem because there are these people called Christians meeting, and they're worshipping someone called Christ, and I don't know what to do about it. Because they should be worshipping the emperor. So we have that letter as a reference to Christ in that letter. Again, it's retrospective. It's not an eyewitness account or anything like that. Similarly with Tacitus and Suetonius, who were Roman historians, again, early second century, so well after Jesus. They reference Tacitus, for instance, in his histories called the Annals, references this person called Christ or Crestus, who Nero actually, but it sort of comes up because Nero, the Roman emperor, blamed the Christians for the fire in Rome. And he references the Christians as followers of this person called Christ, who was executed under Pontius Pilate. So there's a kind of historical location for Christ, for Jesus in this instance. And then we have a Jewish historian called Josephus. Suetonius, by the way, similar kind of reference to Tacitus is. Josephus, in a little bit earlier, in his Antiquities of the Jews, so he wrote a history of the Jewish people. Very interesting character, actually, but there's no time to get into that. But anyway, he wrote this history, and in it, he refers to somebody called Christ. And we're going to read a little passage here from what he wrote. It is interesting. This one, historians thought that Christians had changed this history, you know, edited it to make it sound more like there was a person called Jesus Christ. And you look at it, it does sort of look a bit bogus and looks a little bit of a forgery. In the 1970s, they found an Arabic copy of this text, which seems much more accurate to the original, that doesn't call Jesus the Messiah, which is what these other versions said, but refers to him in a different kind of way, which you'll see here. At this time, there was a wise man who was called Jesus. His conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous, and many people from among the Jews and the other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die, but those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he had appeared to them, so he's saying they reported that he appeared to them. More likely that he would say something like that as a Jew rather than a Christian. They reported that he appeared to him to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders. So he's alluding to this identity of Jesus, Messiah, but not saying he is the Messiah. He's just saying he is perhaps the Messiah. Certainly that's what certain early Jewish followers thought of Jesus. So we have a reference though, a historical reference to Jesus. There are other ones, you know, there's texts, ancient texts that refer to other texts that have since been lost about Jesus. But these are the sort of the four famous ones, the four most reliable ones. What I think we can conclude from this is there's not a lot of information about Jesus out there. We could say Jesus of Nazareth existed, but really when it comes to knowledge about Jesus, understanding Jesus, information about Jesus, we have to turn to the Christian sources. Okay, so let's look at some of the Christian sources. Well, first of all, we have the Gospels, right? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We're going to look at some of those this morning. Also, the Book of Acts. The Book of Acts is more the history of the early church, but it sort of has references to Jesus in it. We can gain some information about Jesus. Obviously, the Gospels are written by followers of Jesus, so they're a little bit biased, right? Just from a historical fact, we have to own that, accept that. But it doesn't mean we can't get lots of good information from them. We also get information about Jesus from other Christian writings, right? Other biblical Christian writings. We can just go through this Does it come up? Yeah, other biblical documents. So there are other books in the Bible, right? Most of them were written by somebody called Paul, an early leader in the Christian movement. He was a sort of devout Jewish Pharisee and became a follower of Jesus as a result of a kind of mystical encounter with the risen Christ. He'd never met Jesus of Nazareth, but writes about to churches and this early Christian movement, writes to them about Jesus. And we can get a lot of information about Jesus' identity from those letters. It's certainly the way the early Christians were thinking about Jesus. We also have other non-biblical documents, or what I would say non-canonical documents. So these are other gospels or other writings that didn't make it into the Bible. Not enough time to go into all that now, but the Christian community made decisions about what books are going to go into the Bible, what books are canon, you know, what books are divinely inspired. And there were differences of opinions about that. So there are other books out there, many of which got lost for centuries because they maybe reflected a thinking about Jesus that became viewed as heretical or unorthodox. And so they had to hide those texts away. And then particularly in the 20th century, we discovered a load of those texts. And there's things like, I'll give you two examples, because I think these writings fall into one of two very big categories. The first one I'll reference is a book called the Infant Gospel of Thomas, or the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. And it's all stories about Jesus as a little boy. It's really bizarre. It's really wacky. It's like Jesus is this kind of mean character who uses his miraculous powers to hurt people. And you know, he's just, I guess, like a typical little boy in a way, but he's got all these divine powers. And there's some point to it. Has anybody read it, by the way? No. I wouldn't bother, really, to be honest. But it's really trying to make the point of how Jesus grows up and sort of gets control in a positive way over his powers. But there's a good reason for it not being in the Bible. Another, though, similar name, the Gospel of Thomas. Has anybody ever read the Gospel of Thomas? Okay, that's that you read it. It's just sayings. It's not a narrative. It's not the stories about Jesus, but it's Jesus' sayings. That's a really good read. I mean, I personally, and but you know, don't judge me for this, but if that was in the Bible, I'd be totally okay with it. You know, it feels very biblical. But you know, it's a little bit more. It's on the more Gnostic side of the Christian tradition for sure. But there's something very beautiful about it too. So you know, but we can glean some things from some of these other sources. Then there's like the early writings. So a little bit later, the first, second, third century, what's called the Church Fathers. These were important writings from the early church about Jesus. But again, retrospective, looking back, thinking back. And then there's another category which has the technical term. In scholarship, a bunch of other stuff, right? In other words, for centuries, people have been talking about Jesus, writing about Jesus, pontificating about Jesus, and there's loads of information out there, right? Loads of information. And probably Jesus is one of the most written about, talked about human beings that's ever existed. So there's plenty of information out there. So what do we do with all that information? And what I want to do this morning is home in on the Gospels, unapologetically, because I think there's good reason to trust the Gospels. Now, what I mean by that is we have so many manuscripts, so many early manuscripts, so many accurate copies, meaning very few discrepancies from manuscript to manuscript, you know, because they were copied over the years. We don't have the originals. We have thousands of those things and way more than other historical documents that are sort of taken for granted. The histories of Herodotus, for instance, or Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars. We have maybe single digit numbers of those manuscripts, and they're all way later than any manuscripts of the Gospels. So we have some validity to these Gospels, but we also know that they're a bit biased, right? We just have to own that. They're writing for a purpose. The writers of the Gospels have a purpose in the writing, so we just need to bear that in mind. Let's look at the Gospels. So there's four of them. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and that's not an error. I've put Mark first because Mark was almost certainly the first gospel to be written, around about AD 60, probably 60 in the common era. And Mark's theme is Jesus as a suffering Messiah. We're going to dip into Mark a little bit this morning. So Jesus is the Messiah. That's the point that the author of Mark is making. But it's a kind of the Messiah was this Hebrew notion of a coming human being. There was no sense of the human of the Messiah being divine, but this human would come who would set Israel free. There would be sort of religious liberation, political liberation. It had nationalistic tendencies. It was a kind of very much a vanquishing our foes theme to Messiahhood. Mark talks about Messiahhood, but is talking about it in very different terms. It's the suffering Messiah, a selfless servant Messiah. Matthew and Luke both use Mark, it seems, because so much of the material in Mark, word for word even, is used by Matthew and Luke. They also draw on their own sources, and they also seem to draw on a common source, a source that was common to Matthew and Luke. And they write their Gospels, Matthew, really trying to show continuity with the Hebrew tradition, with the Jewish faith. So for the writer of Matthew, Jesus is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. So Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, I did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it, right? So this isn't like Jesus. So for Matthew, and I think this is something we could all embrace, Jesus didn't come to start another religion. It's not just Jesus coming along saying, this is wrong, that's wrong, the other one. This is what's right. You know, here's a new religion. Now follow this one and judge everybody else who disagrees with it, you know, because that's what happens with religion. No, Jesus is breaking down the barriers of religion, breaking down the barriers between human beings, the barriers between human beings and God. Luke writes, again, with a sort of Hebrew theme, but as we looked at Luke last year quite a bit, we did two series on the Gospel of Luke. Jesus is the rejected Hebrew prophet. So he comes in the tradition of the Hebrew prophets, but he's rejected. And that gives Luke a way to talk about Jesus being the Messiah, the Savior for everyone. Jesus goes as a rejected Hebrew prophet to the Gentiles. So the message of Luke is very much to the outsiders. It's a very inclusive message. And the author of Luke also writes the book of Acts, which is the church expanding out into the pagan Greek culture. And then we have John, which is where Jesus is this divine being. I've just called it the man from heaven. It's like there's it's very mysterious. And Jesus is talking like a divine being. There's not a lot of, not a lot that is hidden or veiled. It's like Jesus is divine. And we're going to touch on that a little bit in John. So we're going to look at, what I want to do is dip into Mark, dip into John as a way of trying to look at how did the early followers of Jesus, people who were around Jesus, this historical figure, and people who were around people who were around Jesus. Because if you think about it, AD 60, if Mark was written in AD 60, that's 30 years or so after the death of Jesus. That would be like us reading a biography about someone like Freddie Mercury, right? And that's kind of, I remember that. I remember him. We would probably, some of us might know people who knew him. You know, so there's something very real and tangible about when they started writing these. So we want to look at what were they thinking about Jesus and why, and how did that evolve over time and why? Because we have different views about Jesus in these Gospels. And I think that kind of helps us ground these intentions, because there's a bias, there's an agenda in each of these Gospels. It will help us perhaps ground some of these intentions in history, in reality. It could be some anchor points for us. So let's jump into Mark. Mark's gospel starts quite dramatically in a way. Maybe we could put up, very first verse of Mark, the beginning of the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. And then it launches into Jesus's adult life. There's no birth narrative. Mark, the author of Mark, doesn't need to persuade people with miraculous birth stories, virgin birth and angels and this, that, and the other. Mark is writing about what Jesus did, how Jesus lived, what he taught. That's the agenda. And he's going to make the case that Jesus is the Messiah. Some manuscripts do not include that term, Son of God. So let's just say, okay, Mark's point is Jesus is the Messiah. And for the first, so it's 16 chapters in Mark, for the first 8 chapters, case after case is made that Jesus is the Messiah, Jesus is the Messiah, Jesus is the Messiah. And it's a bit of a comedy as well, because the disciples don't get it. There's demons in the stories and they get it, but the disciples don't get it. And you know, and we all laugh at that, you know, but we're also in for a bit of a surprise as we read Mark as well. Well, we're not, because we've read it so many times. We can't read it like it was meant to be read for the first time, right? Unfortunately. But the first eight chapters are Jesus is the Messiah. And we get to chapter eight, and there's a story about a blind man being given his sight. And it happens, you know, Jesus heals him and he can see a bit, and then he does it again and he can see properly. And it's sort of mirroring the blindness of the disciples. It's good storytelling. And then we get this passage in chapter eight. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" Well, that's the question we're asking this morning, right? They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, who had been killed, so executed, so John the Baptist come back from the dead. Others say Elijah, who didn't apparently die. And still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about it. So we have this revelation. Finally, Peter gets it. Jesus is the Messiah. But then right after this, here's what happens. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man, one of Jesus' favorite terms for himself, must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that it must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul?" Now, there's somewhat cryptic language there of Jesus, because he's the cross. He hasn't died on the cross yet, obviously. So this that reference to the cross would be just like Roman execution. You know, where's Jesus going with this? But what is happening here is Peter gets it. Jesus is the Messiah. But then Jesus redefines what messiahhood is, what messiahship is. It's not about power and control. It's not about vanquishing your foes. It's not about defeating your enemies. It's about selfless love, sacrifice, suffering. And Peter does not get that. And so for the rest of Mark's gospel, from chapters 8 onwards to 15, and there's a final chapter, 16, which we'll touch on in a second. The rest of Mark's gospel, it's Jesus showing them and telling them about the nature of messiahship. It's about suffering. It's about servanthood. It's not just the whole point of life is suffering. It's just like, if you love, if you live sacrificially, if you live nonviolently, if you live openly and lovingly, then you're inevitably going to suffer. And that's what happens to Jesus. And Mark builds this case, and he's not made any, there's no allusions to, in the birth narrative that God had this big plan or whatever, and you know, angels telling the story and that kind of thing. He's just, here's Jesus, here's his life, here's what he taught, here's what he was about. And it's incredibly powerful, it's incredibly convincing. And then we get to the end, and Jesus actually dies. What he says comes true. He lives this out to the point of death. And right at the end, it's as if the way, not just the way Jesus lives makes him the Messiah, but the way Jesus dies makes him the Messiah, because he doesn't fight back. He doesn't return violence with violence. He doesn't return darkness with darkness. And so the person by the cross, who's the Roman centurion, do you remember, because we looked at this a little bit when we looked at the sayings of Jesus from the cross during Lent. In Mark's gospel, Jesus says one thing and one thing only from the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me?" There's this anguish of suffering and abandonment, a sense of abandonment. But Jesus was willing to go there. And the centurion stood by the cross. It says he saw how Jesus died and said, "Surely this is the Son of God." Not just Messiah, Son of God. And so what the writer of Mark is doing is beginning to ascribe deity to these qualities, right? These qualities of love, of sacrifice, of selflessness, they kind of transcend humanity. There's something divine about them. They're not expecting the Messiah to be divine. There's no expectation of that. But somehow this is more than that. And then we get the resurrection in Mark. And it's very muted. There's actually no account of the resurrection. We don't see Jesus. There's just an empty tomb. And the women see the empty tomb, and then it ends. And it's as though we're invited into this mystery. Like, has Jesus risen from the dead? I mean, what can we participate? I think it's an invitation to participate in the possibility of resurrection, the possibility that this way of love, of sacrifice, of selflessness, that's what sets people free. Jesus evidently came not just to set a nation free, not just to defeat an enemy, but to deal with the human condition of fear and hatred, and everything that separates us from one another. There's something much more universal, if you like, much more cosmic that's gone on for Jesus to, that's the work that Jesus has done. That's the work of the Messiah. And it's divine work. And we're invited into it. There is an ending at Mark that talks about Jesus coming back from the dead, but it's a much later edition. It actually reads, it's pretty wacky. It's got about snake handlers and all that stuff in it. And it reads like one of those gospels I was mentioning earlier. But the original version of Mark does not, it's just an empty tomb. And we're invited into that. Now we're going to take a little 30-second pause here, because if you're in middle school or high school, I believe you are going to head out to have some discussions of your own about some of the things that we've been talking about so far. So if you want to head out with Trish and the other leaders, you're welcome to stay if you'd like to. I won't take it personally though. So the Gospel of Mark builds up for this human Jesus and then sort of concludes with, what the heck is going on here? It seems like Jesus, this divine quality to Jesus. And I think what happened over the decades of this early church, they're wrestling with, okay, there's something special about Jesus. There's something more than just humanity to Jesus. He's this real human figure. But there's something else going on here. And by the time the Gospel of John is written, that thinking has really evolved. John was written maybe 50 years later. Maybe the end of the first century, possibly the beginning of the second century. And in John, it culminates in first of all, the person of Jesus is a very divine, kind of not altogether human person, speaks with incredible authority, speaks with incredible wisdom, and is sort of has this divine quality to him. But if we go to towards the end of John, we get this story which recounts the resurrection in much more detail. So we see the risen Christ. It says, now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came, when Jesus appeared to them after his death. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them, though the doors were locked. Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Stop doubting and believe. Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. Then Jesus told him, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. So here is the author of John narrating somebody saying to Jesus, my Lord and my God. God, theos in the original Greek that this was written in. God. But Lord is an even more spectacular word, because it's the word in Greek, it's kyrios, which was the word used to translate the Hebrew word Adonai for God. So if you look at the Greek version of the Hebrew scriptures, written in the Greek language, translated into the Greek language, whenever it says Adonai, you get kyrios. That's what Lord means. Adonai was the word that the Hebrews used to replace the sacred word for God, that word we looked at over the past couple of weeks, Yahweh, or we don't even know how to say it because it was so sacred, it wasn't spoken, and so sacred they stopped writing it down. They just used the word Adonai. It's the word that comes from the root I am. God is being. God is not just a being, but God is being, as we've looked at over the last 2 weeks. This has been equated with Jesus. That's who Thomas, that's the label Thomas is using for Jesus. Pretty incredible. They're beginning to think now that, okay, Jesus was God. Jesus is divine. But it's not just at the end. We get this in the middle. So in chapter 8 of John, Jesus is talking to the Pharisees. Your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad. They say back to him, "You are not 50 years old," they said to him, "and you have seen Abraham?" "Very truly, I tell you," Jesus answered, "before Abraham was born, I am." At this, they picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus hid himself, slipping away from the temple grounds. So here's Jesus self-referencing as "I am," right? So it's like in John's gospel, Jesus gets that he's divine, using this term "I am." And of course, in John's gospel, from the get-go, Jesus is presented as divine. If you think of the things we read at Christmas time, we read the narratives from Luke and Matthew about Jesus' birth, but we also read John chapter 1. We're going to read that together now. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light." He's talking about John the Baptist. "So that through him all might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." Okay, don't have a lot of time left here, so we've got to unpack that somehow. This slide might help us a little bit. Let's look at what we're seeing here. So here is the author of John explaining to us about a mystery that's really hard to wrap your head around, that in this person of Jesus of Nazareth, who's about to come on the stage, right? Jesus is about to appear in John's narrative. He's prologuing that with, look, this is no normal human being. Okay, this is a divine being. And let me explain to you what's going on here. That's kind of what the author of John's thinking. I'm not saying I'm going to do a very good job of that. But what we have from this prologue is, okay, Jesus is divine. The Christ, the Logos, the cosmic Christ, the universal Christ, different labels that we would give this entity, it's divine. We say it's God, and it was with God in the beginning. We get some of this plurality of God, this community of God that we were talking about last week, right? God's not an individual. There's something plural about God. We got that. So this is divine. It's cosmic. It's from the beginning. There's lots of language that is reminiscent of the Hebrew creation myths here, right? In the beginning, God created. So in the beginning was the Word. So it's about, it transcends existence. It transcends being. It transcends time and space. It's cosmic. It's about, you know, matter being created. It's about life. It's about light. All those things, you know, the light being the first element of creation. It's as though whatever we're talking about here is kind of wrapped around reality as we know it. It's before reality and after reality. It's sort of related to perhaps when we say things like "in him we live and move and have our being," which is a Greek statement, a Greek philosophical thought that Paul, that is recounted in the book of Acts. So it's cosmic. This is everything. When we've talked about that in week one, that God is being, God is depth, God is everything. We get this sense of universe, this everythingness. It's universal, right? So we get these, it's universal in every way. We get these metaphors of the Logos, which is a Greek thought about ultimate reality, ultimate meaning in the universe, sort of what rationally holds everything together. So we get that Greek thought, but we also have this is Hebrew thinking, right? Because the Word is how in Genesis is how things are created. God speaks things into existence. So it's even the metaphors used sort of apply to everyone, but we also get language of it's for all people, okay? It's for anyone and everyone, and it includes all things. It's as though the Christ, the Logos, is creation itself. It's like it's as though pre what you know we would use scientific Big Bang language now, right, to explain how the universe came into existence. Ontologically, philosophically, theologically, the author of John is saying, look, at some point there was God. God is what has always been. God is being. And this God is sort of, it's plural and it's flowing, as we were talking about last week. And it's self-deferential. It's deferring and interdependent and loving and kind. And there's this beautiful flow. And then that flow kind of tips over this event horizon and becomes creation, becomes matter, becomes energy, becomes everything that we know, everything that we see, everything that we feel, touch, think. It's that's the Christ. That's the universal Christ. That's the cosmic Christ. That it's the universe, right? And everybody's part of that. Nobody's excluded from that. We may not realize it. We may think so. Some people are in and some people are out. No, it's way more universal than that. It's so universal. It's so cosmic. We can't get our hands around it enough to even say who's in and out because everybody's in, right? And not only that, this thing becomes flesh. So this reality, this mystery became flesh. That's what we call the incarnation. That's what John is saying right at the beginning. What you're about to hear about is just something mind-blowing. That not only is the Christ, the flow into reality as creation itself, but is present in space and time in the person of Jesus Christ. Now, I want to fast forward here. We always run out of time on these things. Right? I'm sorry about that, but because the church. So, well, first of all, let me just say that's a very different kind of presentation of who Jesus is than we saw in Mark. It's very different. Except that at crucial moments, Jesus behaves like the presentation of Jesus we had in Mark. Jesus loves. Jesus restores. Jesus accepts people. Jesus washes people's feet. So this incredible cosmic reality is still servanthood. It's still selfless. And it still dies. It still makes sacrifices. And the early church wrestled with these issues, like who is Jesus? And Paul writes, and we're just going to look at a couple of writings from this leader who never met Jesus of Nazareth, but had this mystical encounter with the risen Christ that transformed his life, and then writes not so much about Jesus' teachings, barely mentions Jesus' teachings, but talks about the meaning of Jesus. What is the meaning of Christ and Christ's life, death, and resurrection? And he writes this, the Son, talking about Jesus, the Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. Beginning to sound like John, right? For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether on thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning of the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. So very similar thing to like Jesus embodied that cosmic reality. And then there's this reference to shed blood on the cross, which we can sort of shrink down to, oh yeah, Jesus had to be punished by God as sort of retribution for this, that, and the other. Or it's no, the irony is, or the surprise, the shock is that this force, this power, this love is sacrificial. It's not dominant, it's loving, it's kind, it's embodied by servanthood. And we get that in Philippians. So Paul writes another letter to the church in Philippians where he talks about, describes this same kind of quality to the reality of Christ. Therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and one of mind. So it's an appeal to love one another. Don't try to get ahead of one another. Make room for one another. Just do what Jesus did. Live like Jesus taught. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus. Okay? Jesus, the Messiah. That word Christ means Messiah. So, what was that like? Well, he who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. There's that sacrifice again. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow. In heaven and on earth and under the earth, you can see Paul likes using that kind of, you know, that language. And every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, Kurios, to the glory of God the Father. So this isn't Jesus being Lord so that it's like, okay, I flowed out and emptied myself. The Greek word for that, kenosis, is a sort of theological term. This servant-hearted love is not poured out so that then I can pick myself up and then I'll kick butt and vanquish my foes. No, this is a different kind of Lord. What we're hearing here is the very fabric of the universe, the nature of reality is love. And that love is manifest through selflessness, through servanthood, which ultimately is almost inevitably going to mean suffering. But that's okay. That's how love is manifest in the world. And then here's the real miracle, I think, in Ephesians. Paul again, writing about a similar kind of thing. He says, I keep asking that the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, the glorious Father, may give you the spirit of wisdom and revelation so that you may know him better. I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened in order that you may know the hope to which he has called you. The riches of his glorious inheritance in his holy people and his incomparably great power for us who believe. He's talking to us now about us. That power is the same as the mighty strength he exerted when he raised Christ from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly realms. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, far above all rule and authority, power and dominion, and every name that is evoked, not only in the present age, but also in the one to come. And God placed all things under his feet and appointed him to be head over everything for the church. Listen to this. Which is his body, the fullness of him who fills everything in every way. So we as human beings are the fullness of God. Like we are incarnations of God. We are incarnations of that incredible reality. That's why Paul calls us in Philippians to live like Christ, to be servant-hearted, to be loving. When he says that the church is the fullness of that fullness, he's not talking about some powerful church. He's not talking about some big, dynamic, ginormous church that makes an absolutely incredible impact on the world, like us. He's talking about a fledgling community that's barely managing, that's persecuted and battered down. This is the first century. This is minority religion. Here's what he's saying about that. He's saying, but you embody that power. You have the universe inside of you. And I think this, I'm going to wrap up here. We're going to sing our last song if the band want to come up. We'll get into more about this next week, but I think that's the reality of Christ. When we ask the question, who is Jesus? As followers of Jesus in this tradition, we're really saying, Jesus is the image of the invisible God. If we want to know what God looks like, we look at Jesus. And it's love all the way. It's kindness, kind-heartedness, servanthood, selflessness. It's not about power. It's not about control. So when we look at the things we were talking about last week about what might God be like, and we talked about things like vulnerability rather than control. We talked about inclusiveness rather than judgment. We talked about love. That's what we see in Jesus because that's the nature of reality. That's what reality is. And we can have the eyes of our heart opened, you know, our inner eye and opened to understand that and live like that is true. And I think that's what faith is about. We'll talk about faith next week when we talk about what is faith. Faith is trusting Jesus. Saying, okay, everything around me does not feel like this, but I'm going to trust that this is the reality. Everything around me feels like you got to fight to get ahead. Everything around me feels like I'm going to treat people how they deserve to be treated, not how I want them to treat me. But I'm going to trust you that that's the way to go. I'm going to treat people how I want to be treated rather than how they deserve. All these things that Jesus talked about, we can live like that. But it means an enormous amount of trust in that reality that we've just been exploring. And I think that's what the early followers of Jesus were wrestling with. And we see that played out in the Gospels. So let's stand together. I'm going to sing our closing song, because we've already done communion, if you remember. We're going to sing our closing song. And this is a song about the miracle that we embody, everything that we've just been talking about, that we do. And that if we could grasp that reality as human beings, life would be so different. So let's sing together.